And hello and welcome to Public Affair. Our guest today to discuss the role of the Christian right in the American elections and American politics is Senior Fellow at Political Research Associates, Frederick Clarkson. He has been writing about politics and religion for over 30 years. He is the author of Eternal Hostility, The Struggle Between Theocracy and Democracy, editor of Dispatches from the Religious Left, The Future of Faith and Politics in America, and co-author of Challenging the Christian Right, The Activist's Handbook. And hello, Frederick. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hello, Esty. Good to be with you.
So in principle, there is a separation between church and state in the United States. Just how true is that principle anymore?
Well, I'm not sure we've ever had it purely. I think that the framers of the Constitution were pretty clear about it, but they had 300 years of colonial theocracies to undo before they could even get started. And it's been a long road, and we're still working on it. And the other piece is that even as separation of church and state as an idea was written in our founding documents and advanced by the founders of the country, there were a lot of people who disagreed with that from the get-go, and that never stopped. So the struggle is ongoing. We try to improve the right of individual conscience and religious freedom for all, but, you know, there are always theocratic factions who want to get control, and that's still with us.
Would you say that the struggle has actually intensified in the past maybe 3 years or 10 years or 30 years?
Certainly in the past 30, it really was in the 1970s that conservative Christians who, as a matter of theology, generally stayed on the political sidelines. Not entirely, but for the most part, just politics they didn't see as their job and was potentially threatening to their eternal soul for a variety of theological reasons. But the theology started to change, and the sense of political urgency changed as well. And so we began to see Jerry Falwell's Moral Majority and later Pat Robertson's Christian Coalition as various evangelical factions started to become far more politically engaged than they had been for a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And have things gotten even more intensified in recent years, let's say since George W. Bush, or does it just seem like that to me?
Well, it's both yes and no. No, in the sense that there's been a generational change since the founders of the Christian right, as we know them, people like Pat Robertson and James Dobson, are either retiring or passing altogether from the scene. And like with any big movements, organizations, institutions, when the larger-than-life founders pass, there's a lot of difficulty making the transition into what it's going to become. And so in one sense, there'd been a subsiding on the national level of some of that. George Bush got all the attention for a long time. But that reorganization process is largely complete, and we're now seeing a much more reinvigorated and politically dynamic Christian right. It's become the new movement, and I think that's what you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to get into details throughout the hour, but if I ask you for a large picture take, how effective have they been? How much have they influenced American politics, both domestic and foreign? How important is the Christian right when you look at what's going on in this country and the way this country deals with the rest of the world?
Well, they're vitally important. They are, if not the majority, you know, certainly a significant faction within the Republican Party. So here you have, you know, a significant player in one of the two major parties in the largest, you know, nation in the world. It plays a superpower presence. So, yes, the Christian right is not just a group of religious conservatives active in political life, they're electing their people to national office. Mm-hmm. And there's just no question in terms of domestic policy, in terms of aspects of foreign policy, that they're an incredibly important factor.
Uh-huh. And would you say that there is any kind of movement that counters it from the left, either religious or secular?
No.
No.
No, I think that everybody to the left of the religious right, whether they're moderate Republicans or mainstream Democrats or religious or secular progressives, have done a dismal job of dealing with the new realities of the Christian right for the past couple of decades. And it's not that there aren't bright spots and people doing good things, but in terms of a major substantive response, I think people are pretty much stuck in the politics of the 70s.
Uh-huh. So before we get to look at some of the details, do you have a theory as to why this is? Why is it that the left is so weak in this country?
Why the left generally is weak?
Yes, and why is there no movement that counters this movement of the Christian right?
Well, specifically in relationship to the Christian right, I think that people just don't want to have to think about it. And it's hard. There's a lot of complicated stuff to try to understand, strange beliefs, concerning agendas, and it's difficult to evaluate what's important and what's not. And so if you're from a sheer perspective, you know, what's a political power, like how can you tell what the most extreme noisy people, are they really significant or are they just noisy people? Mm-hmm. But where is the real power coming from? Where does the Christian right really gain its strength? And it takes a lot of knowledge and experience in dealing with that material in order to articulate it and to begin to integrate it into your daily politics and your writing and your thinking and in your public speaking. And the institutions that we have across the left have been slow and resistant to the point of even pushing aside that kind of analysis. It just makes them look too uncomfortable.
Well, that doesn't sound very good. Let's start looking into the details. So there was a rally in Philadelphia this past weekend, correct?
Yes.
By the religious right. And what was it about? Who organized it? And who were some of the characters that that spoke in it? And how successful was it?
It had a mixed success, I would say. We could start with that. It's part of a 30-year tradition, really, of organizing these prayer rallies right before an election. First one was called Washington for Jesus in 1980, and 500,000 people came. And it was one of the largest events of the Christian right ever, and it was transformational in the politics of the Christian right. It engaged a lot of people who've been previously apolitical, as we were talking about a few minutes ago. Mm-hmm. The one in Philadelphia, in front of Independence Hall, where the Declaration of Independence was drafted and where the Constitution was signed, this only drew about 10,000 people. Mm-hmm. Now, the mall in Philadelphia maybe only holds, maybe 20,000 or 30,000 people, but I think the physical presence was disappointing. But that said, things have changed in the era of mass rallies for the Christian right and probably for every other sector. People are tired of them, and they just don't do them as much as they used to, and there's a real question about how effective they are. So what the Christian right did this year was they organized regional rallies. There was one in Dallas where some of the same speakers spoke that drew 7,000 people. So in economic hard times, people don't want to have to spend a lot of money to go to Washington or some other national venue just to have a rally of dubious value. So you bring it closer to home, and you can get people to come. And that made great common sense. But meanwhile, the Christian Right has developed sophisticated broadcasting capabilities far beyond the TV preacher kind of stuff. where they can broadcast from a scene and do live streaming all around the world. There's a network called God TV that broadcasts or live streams the whole thing live. That's how I watch it. And I think that was probably very successful. You can organize viewing parties in churches and homes to see the rally and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
They've adapted well to the technological and economic realities of the 21st century. But some of the speakers were Tony Perkins of the Family Research Council, a notable figure on the Christian right, and a lot of Pat Robertson was there, 82 years old, but still denouncing secularism in the ACLU. And less well-known people like Samuel Rodriguez was there, and quite a raft of people who are present, but much present leaders, but much less well-known, and they're part of the movement that's the new Christian right.
Uh-huh. Well, let's then start talking about some of these people. You mentioned Tony Perkins. Who is he? What is his history? What is he pushing? Who is he?
Okay. Well, Tony Perkins is the head of the Family Research Council, which was started 20 years or so ago, basically as the political arm of James Dobson's Focus on the Family. It's since become independent, but there's still a relationship there. Tony Perkins came out of Louisiana politics. He headed the Focus on the Family political affiliate in the state, but he was also involved in the politics of the far right, and for a Senate candidate that he was a campaign manager for, he acquired the political donor list of neo-Nazi political figure David Duke. Mm. So he's willing to play footsie with the very, very far right. At the same time, he's a handsome and avuncular and effective and charismatic political leader who speaks well and is effective on TV. But wherever you're talking about the anti-abortion agenda or the anti-gay, and particularly anti-gay marriage agenda in Washington, he is the point man, or one of the point men, on all of these kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. What about the Reverend Samuel Rodriguez? Who is he?
He's a very interesting man. He heads an organization called the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, which, if it sounds familiar, is actually intended as an echo of Martin Luther King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And he casts himself as a mix between Billy Graham, the great evangelical leader, and Martin Luther King, as he likes to put it, with a little salsa thrown in.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very engaging figure, and he considers himself nonpartisan. He's been very effective dealing with two White Houses on immigration reform issues. But after immigration reform, he is a leader of the Christian right, and he's been very involved in targeting, micro-targeting, really, evangelical Latinos who are anti-abortion and anti-gay marriage, and focusing on their political and electoral development so that the emerging Latino demographic, just generally, becomes politically dominated by this narrow Christian right faction. He, at the same time, the mainstream media is treating him as a moderate evangelical, sort of the Latino Rick Warren. And pretty much people inside the Beltway have their minds frozen about this guy. He's so important on immigration, they feel, that they can't really talk about him being a leader of the far Christian right. Probably one of the most interesting people in politics.
Uh-huh. And so that really raises a question that I asked before, but in a more specific way, within the Hispanic Latino community, are there leaders whose agenda is very different from his, and who also have their own followers, or is he really the one big name within this population?
he likes to present himself as the guy, and as you know how it is with the media, they like to focus on one guy.
Mm-hmm. And he's a handsome one, too.
And I'm not an expert on the Latino community, but I'm certain that among the tens of millions of Latinos, among people who've recently come to the country and people who've been here for centuries, there are many, many, many effective Latino political and religious leaders, and you don't always have to go to Sam Rodriguez. That's just silly.
Mm-hmm.
On its face, it's silly. But yes, I think that there are plenty of obvious alternatives to go to, and that's really time for the media and for particularly the leaders of the Democratic Party and liberal interest groups to look beyond Sam Rodriguez. He does not support their agenda.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't. He's aggressively opposed to the Democratic Party and to liberal interest groups, whom he denounces all the time.
Mm-hmm. Frederick, I haven't even given the numbers yet, but we do have two callers waiting to talk to you. My guest is Frederick Clarkson. He's a senior fellow at Political Research Associates, the writer of writer and editor of three books, has been writing for over 30 years about politics and religion. And that's what we're talking about today, the influence of the Christian right on these current elections and politics generally in the United States. Let's go to our first caller. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Yes. Well, you know, churches historically have served to anoint, legitimize, advocate for, against whatever political system from the pulpit. And over the last 20 years, we've had the last three presidencies have increasingly pushed these faith-based initiatives, which confuse the role of church and state because the state is now subsidizing church social functions. So there's a carrot there for the church to interfere and push whatever political candidate promises to give them the most bucks. I just wonder, what is your perception or feeling about faith-based initiatives?
Thank you.
I think they should be stopped immediately.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about the faith-based initiative, and there was a former White House staffer, Bush staffer named David Kuo, who actually worked in the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives, and he's still a conservative evangelical, but he's had a change of heart about a lot of what's going on with the faith-based initiatives. He recognized that the original justification was a fraud. You know, quite aside from the church-state issues, part of the justification was that somehow religious groups were at a disadvantage in applying for federal grants and contracts, when in fact that was just never the case. In fact, religious groups are always welcome to apply for federal grants and contracts and have received them and performed admirably, both in terms of domestic social poverty alleviation kinds of things, as well as foreign aid and charitable work. It's never, ever actually been an issue. It was a made-up controversy in order, as you suggest, to funnel money to favored religious factions for political return. It's a terrible scandal, quite aside from the church and state questions, and David Kuo was very honest about it, I felt.
Mm-hmm. So here in Madison, we have had a controversy about a choice school, and there are, of course, choice schools popping up all over the place, and some of them are good, I think, and some of them are not. They're definitely being pushed by the religious right, and it makes me wonder, that as well as many other things actually make me wonder about the connection between capitalism and theocratic politics. Can you address that? It seems that there's always a money interest behind these things that are being masked, I think, as religious.
Now, you want to deal with the school choice issue particularly, or more broadly?
Let's do both. Let's start with the schools and go farther.
Okay. The it's something that I've looked into a bit. I first looked into the school choice kinds of issues probably 20 years ago when in Texas. And what was going on there with charter schools, was that business interests certainly wanted to have for-profit schools, and religious groups, including African-American religious groups, who were being screwed by urban public school systems, wanted to be able to get state money to have private charters. And there was tremendous battles going on. But there was no question that that big business interests were explicitly aligned with religious groups in order to be able to tap the big pool of public funds for their own purposes. That's been clear from the beginning, and it plays out on a national scale every day for those who care to look. And it's not a big secret. I think from a religious right perspective, many are concerned about the public schools essentially being a competition for their worldview. They want to have a Christ-centered or God-centered kind of education that reflects their particular biblical worldview. But a public school that's well done doesn't reflect any one particular view, particularly religious view, because usually people in the classroom represent quite a range of points of view. We don't hire teachers and government officials to be religious instructors or priests. We hire them to be teachers mm-hmm. and to present a variety of points of view and help to teach us how to be how to get along with one another in a religiously plural society. There's a lot of problems in terms of the conflict with the more theocratic factions and how they view the institution of the public schools, which are often openly described as satanic. So this is something that's not going to go away. In terms of the larger issues, the same kinds of things apply. The more theocratic elements of the religious right want to have greater latitude and freedom to use their resources as they will, as well as, in some cases, to try to gain access to public funds to advance their agenda. And we see the same thing playing out with big business interests. They see this value. They, religious groups wanted to decouple from the civil rights laws, from labor laws, from a progressive social agenda. And so they find a common cause. It's pretty easy to see. Mm-hmm. We see it play out with the issue of contraception coverage in insurance. As Catholic and evangelical institutions want greater and greater exemption from the rules that apply to everyone else. If in the case of the Obama administration, you want to make a compromise and say, okay, well, churches don't have to do this, but affiliated hospitals and universities do, that's still considered an unacceptable compromise. And they're going to fight that one as far as they possibly can. So that becomes a precedent for exemption from civil rights laws. We see businesses that are run by conservative Christians seeking this, exactly the same kind of exemptions. And it opens the window to go rolling back many of the social advances of the past 50 years in the name of religious freedom. It's an extraordinary development.
Mm-hmm. I will want to get back to that. Let's get to our second caller first. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Paul, to both of you. Actually, what you're talking about now is really in line with my question. Did the religious right arise spontaneously, or is it a vehicle for that group of people who want the business of government to be business and to have government serve the interests of business? And I'm not talking small businesses. I'm talking basically corporations.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Well, I think it's sort of a both and. I think lots of people come to their views honestly and sincerely and organize as anybody would. But I think it's also true that there are lots of business interests going back many years who some of them were explicitly conservative Christian and looked to that constituency as allied and, say, resisting the advance of the labor movement. There's an entity called The Family or The Fellowship that Jeff Charlotte wrote a best-selling book about mm-hmm. that traces that history going back to at least the 30s in Seattle that later became a national and international movement. And it was specifically designed to organize conservative Christian business leaders to resist the labor movement. So, yeah, it's a complicated matter, but there are at least some of the kinds of things going on that you're referring to where there's a specific convergence of religious and business perspectives that are played out on a national stage.
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I understand fundamentalist thinking, it seems that there is a connection there between having money and being close to God. Presumably, if you are rich because you are good in God's eyes, and so God has given you this money, and therefore things like Mitt Romney's comment about the 47% seems to be just integral to that way of thinking of these people are rejects in the eyes of God, obviously, and so why should I care about them? Is that true, and is that part of this worldview?
Well, it's true sometimes, and it's not true other times, because across the evangelical and fundamentalist spectrum, there are quite a range of views about these things. In some cases, it's exactly as you described. In other cases, it may be that even within a strict Calvinist and predestination point of view, you might be rich or you might be poor, and you were destined to be that, but doesn't necessarily mean that you're any closer to God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that in the case of Mitt Romney, he's just a sneering plutocrat, you know, appealing to other sneering plutocrats and reflecting an Ayn Rand kind of point of view that describes anybody who's receiving any kind of public benefit, you know, as a parasite and a moocher. And that's an attitude that has doesn't necessarily reflect a particular religious point of view, although it can. I would say that many conservative Christians and Mormons, among others, have adopted the Austrian School of Economics view, which is pretty much entirely laissez-faire, and the less government regulation of the economy you can have, the better off everybody is. For the people who think that that rich is good and closer to God, that allows them to behave in the most economically ruthless way and not consider the consequences of their actions and their inactions, and think that they're still godly people.
No.
Yeah, there's quite a range of views, but they somehow manage to find common cause when they organize politically.
Mm-hmm. Join this conversation with Frederick Clarkson about the Christian right and its effect and influence on American politics. And we have another caller for you, Frederick. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Very interesting discussion with Frederick, SD.
Thank you.
I think his words, parasitic in that last statement, was very interesting. I would look at the intertwinement of church and state at this point in our country as kind of either symbiotic at best, perhaps parasitic, and I'm just wondering how the guests would feel about... I just think it's an interesting situation where all these religious institutions are getting a free ride in terms of tax status if the revokement of that status might change their intertwinement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Frederick.
Well, it certainly would, but just as a practical matter, it's never going to happen. It's a political non-starter. There are too many people who are deeply invested in the C3 tax status, and there's no politician in America, to my knowledge, who has ever taken a view that C3 status should be revoked for religious institutions. But as you think about it, why should anybody get a C3 tax status, an arts organization or a university or a hospital? And once you start to argue that one class of organizations and people should not have a C3 tax status, it raises the question about tax exemption in general. So even though in one sense it can seem like a really appealing idea, it's a political non-starter, and once you open the door of the precedent, you're going to open up a whole lot of other questions.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to Mitt Romney and to Mormonism. What is the place of the Mormon Church in this movement? Has it been active? Has it been a major player until now? And how is the Mormon dogma affecting the current elections?
Well, the Mormons are always in a complicated matter. Just like other religious institutions, there are both Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
We should remind ourselves that the Democratic majority leader, Harry Reid, is
right.
a Mormon.
Yeah.
Senator Mark Udall, you know, from Senator from Colorado. And there's a long history of moderate and liberal Democrats who also happen to be Mormons. And it's important to keep that in mind as we talk about these things. That said, the institutional church has tended to be conservative, politically speaking, and conservative Mormons have tended to align themselves with the Christian right as it's developed over the decades. Sometimes being rather unhappy about it. There was one episode where Christian Wright had taken over a local school board in Southern California, and at the first school board meeting, these Pentecostal school board members and their supporters in the audience started to treat the whole affair like a revival meeting. They were standing up and waving their arms and praising Jesus, and the conservative Mormons and who were there and had been a part of the coalition were just aghast.
Uh-huh.
Aghast. So these are very uneasy things, particularly because many of the kinds of conservative Christians we've been talking about, Southern Baptists and Calvinist Presbyterians, absolutely view Mormonism as a dangerous heresy or a cult. And there's nothing that's going to change their view about that. They might see that Romney's politics and economics might more closely reflect theirs than Barack Obama's, but they will never, ever vote for a Mormon. That just isn't going to happen for many of them. And they may not be willing to say that to a pollster, but the former Southern Baptists I know and were raised in that environment know that it's true, and their family members feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's with Mormons, it's complicated.
Uh-huh. Do you happen to know if Rocky Anderson was running as a third party? I think it's the Justice Party. Oh, what is it? Do you know if he's a Mormon? Because he was the mayor of Salt Lake City.
You know, I don't know. I would guess that he is, but I really couldn't say for sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I was just
But he would have been a Democrat.
Yeah, well, and I don't know if you watched the debates on Democracy Now, where he and Jill Stein got opportunities to comment on what Obama and Romney were saying, and I don't know, to me seemed right on. Both of them.
I didn't happen
to
see that, but that's interesting to hear.
Yeah, it was actually a little hard to differentiate between their positions. The parts that I saw, anyway, I really did not watch the whole thing. But let's get back to then what makes the Christian right movement. So we say fundamentalist, but that's not just one stream, is it? There's a variety of them. Give us maybe a little bit of description of who they are. What are their colors politically? And are they the leaders of the movement? Are the Catholics? How do the fundamentalists and the Catholics get along together, or don't?
Well, that's a long and complicated history too. People who followed history in these things know that there was a time when in many parts of the country that Catholics were a hated and feared minority, and sort of Protestant nativists did everything they could to marginalize Catholics, fairly or unfairly, and they were often persecuted, and there were some horrible things. It was a long time for Catholics to be treated as equals in American society. So that history, you know, still stings for people. I even know Catholics here in Massachusetts who feel, you know, still as second-class citizens. So we have a ways to go in that regard. That said, the conservative Catholicism and the Protestant Christian right have been, the leaders have been trying to figure out a way to work better together for a long time. There is the historic animosities between the factions. We've even recently had Al Mohler, a prominent Southern Baptist seminary president, you know, said to Larry King that the papacy is not a legitimate Christian office, mm-hmm. and did just a full bore, you know, fundamentalist Southern Baptist attack on the legitimacy of the Catholic Church. So others trying to find ways to politically work together are still working with that environment. I think that the news here is that they have succeeded in the last few years to a very substantial degree. And they had a real breakthrough with something called the Manhattan Declaration. And anybody can just Google this, the Manhattan Declaration, where they got a bunch of prominent Catholic leaders, including bishops and cardinals, to sign on with people like James Dobson and Samuel Rodriguez to declare that they were in favor of three things they could find absolute common ground on. And you will hear these phrases reflected, for example, in Mitt Romney's speech at the Republican convention, and in this order. They are pro-life or pro-sanctity of life. They are in favor of the sanctity of traditional marriage, and they're in favor of religious freedom. Life, marriage, religious freedom, in that order. Very simple set of ideas and messages. And their success in formulating that basic set of ideas has allowed the greatest political convergence of conservative Protestants and conservative Catholics in American history.
Uh-huh. So let's talk about these things. Pro-life, when and why did abortion become such a major issue in American politics, and does it really come from some very deep conviction? Well, I'm sure by now it does to some, but was there a cabal of men who met in some smoky room and decided that this is a wedge issue that can get them points? Or how did that become such a major issue in the United States, and really it has been exported throughout the world?
Well, initially when Roe v. Wade was passed by the Supreme Court, the only major, there was no huge outcry from the conservative Protestant world. They didn't care that much about it. It wasn't their issue. It was a Catholic issue. It took a number of years for conservative Protestants to begin to organize around this and begin to treat it as a serious issue. At the time, the Southern Baptist Convention was moderately pro-choice. They didn't think that people should be able to run out and get abortions if they wanted them, but they did respect that there were occasions when a woman might need one, and that was okay. But where the turning points really came was with the founding of the Moral Majority in the mid-70s. Now, the Moral Majority originally got together, organized by Paul Warrick, around the issue of tax exemption. There's a C3 issue again, on conservative white Christian academies, because the IRS was enforcing civil rights laws and integration via the tax code, and you wouldn't be able to allow it to be a tax-exempt school if you were going to segregate or otherwise discriminate against African-Americans. Well, the Southern conservative Protestants didn't like this one bit, and they began to organize on that issue. Then they would find themselves in meetings, and they'd say, well, you know, as long as we've got this, what else shall we work on? And somebody said, how about abortion? Mm-hmm. And that's how that got started. It's almost as simple as that. They were concerned about abortion, but not enough to make it a part of a political agenda. It took protecting their C3 tax status around the issue of segregation to bring abortion in as a significant political agenda item.
Mm-hmm. That is so interesting. How about traditional marriage? When and why did that become a major issue in their agenda, on their agenda?
Well, I don't have as good a story around that, but the best of my understanding is how that came about was that gay equality and gay rights and the recognition of the status of couples for example, around insurance questions, recognition of gay couples as domestic partners, inevitably it was going to lead to the question of marriage. The marriage question was always out there. It was just a question of when it would start to become a concern. From my research and looking at what the focus on the family political affiliates, such as the one that Tony Perkins came out of in Louisiana, is they were doing polling on this for a long time and trying to figure out how best to approach the question, turn the question of traditional family values into the question of protection of the family in terms of, and then protection of marriage. And marriage polled very well. So defending traditional marriage against the gay agenda was going to be a winner in terms of polling. And generally that's turned out to be true. And that is that the people who oppose marriage equality have won every single ballot initiative that's come up at the state level. So it's taken a long time, and they've refined their methods over time, but that they knew what they were doing when they got into it. And it wasn't just about gay marriage. It was about how do you use this to build your entire movement and use it as an organizing principle.
Sounds really like it's a lot more about gaining political power than it is about convictions.
It's about both, you know. You need to have political power in order to advance your whole agenda, but there are going to be some issues that are going to be more potent than others. And so you have to have both if you're going to be serious about it. So anyone who's concerned about marriage equality needs to understand that there's a much larger picture going on. The people who are concerned about separation of church and state and the right of individual conscience and all those kinds of good issues also need to understand that marriage and abortion are the battlegrounds. The question of religious freedom is absolutely foundational in terms of the future of separation of church and state in the United States. So to see very clearly how the Christian right and the Evangelical Catholic Alliance is working on these things together is to see very clearly what the battle is going to be like for the foreseeable future.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense, this whole notion of religious freedom is a myth, isn't it? I mean, has there ever not, or, you know, any at least in the last, let's say, 30 years or so, there hasn't been suppression of Christianity in any way, has there?
Well, I certainly wouldn't see it that way.
Yeah.
The way that some of the Christian right would see it is that they, because their worldview is so different than yours and mine, most of the listeners, I imagine, let's just try to imagine how, if you really believe in a conservative Christian worldview, and it's your job as an evangelical or as a conservative Catholic to advance the Christian worldview and to make it real in society. That's your job as a Christian. And so you want to create as much public space as you can to say the things that you want to on the occasions that you want to, and you want to be able to use institutions and arenas of all kinds, whether it's the public school or the presidency or a business, to turn it to your advantage to be able to evangelize, to be able to control those institutions to advance a particular Christian agenda. It's imperial in a certain sense. It's aggressive. It's violative of the rights of others. It's, at best, rude. But that's how the worldview works for a lot of these folks. And so when others come along and say that, well, you know, you can't stand up in school and, you know, start praying and preaching to the students. You can't take the school microphone in the morning and as the principal and start praying to all the students. You can't use public resources to advance your particular religious agenda to them. That is offensive. That's what they call persecution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's understood a little bit differently than for people that are not of their point of view. When they say persecution, that's what they mean. It's basically obstacles to the agenda.
Mm-hmm. So the view is really fundamentally anti-democratic. It really is theocratic. Yes?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. If you define theocracy and theocratic, not in terms of old academic categories in which the ministers run the government. You have effective theocracy and theocratic politics when you're using the resources of government to dominate people of other points of view or to evangelize them or to control them. You can turn your public school into a theocratic agency, even if they're not specifically espousing theocracy, because they're using public resources to pressure others.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the phones. Hi, caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Say, I was really curious about your analysis of the how abortion became a national issue. It became an issue there throughout the nation.
Yeah.
Of it having its roots in the interest of white Southern folks who did not want to send their children to those public schools that had recently integrated. I wonder if you could take a second to explain that a little bit more to all of us, and that if you think that motivation is still quite current in their vapid notions, because, you know, we've got a black president. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Frederick.
Well, I certainly, as I said earlier, that the people who want to preserve their private white Christian academies and receive a tax exemption to do it were very motivated. They, and as I say, abortion became a rallying issue, but also a question of what they saw as a creeping decadence, and the federal government decreeing that something that they thought was murder was going to be okay. Yeah, so the liberals were at it again. Liberals were going to make it force white people to have to go to school with black people and like it, and they were going to allow people to kill babies as well. That's how they viewed it.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the larger issue of racism in the white conservative Southern movement, certainly there's elements of that that are still there, and you can see it and hear it from time to time. But at the same time, there are elements of the Christian right that are explicitly anti-racist, explicitly multicultural, and are very, very sincere and good at it. And if you watched the America for Jesus rally, you saw a very multiracial event, mostly because it's coming out of historic Pentecostalism and its recent variation called the New Apostolic Reformation, that has always had a streak of recognizing that regardless of your race, your ethnic background, you can all be brothers and sisters in Christ. And that's something to understand, that one of the great strengths of this element of the Christian right is that they are that diverse. And so even as there's a certain strain of traditional white fundamentalist racism that you're going to see, you're also going to see this explicitly and very effectively non-racist element that is probably more politically dynamic and theocratically dangerous than the old white fundamentalists right now.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Let's get to our next caller. Hi, caller, you on the air.
Hi there. I was just wondering I certainly appreciate the Freedom From Religion Foundation, but are there groups who go after, it seems like the only place to start going after these groups is going after their tax-exempt status. I mean, certainly, it's just so political, their activity, surrounding abortion and those issues.
Gay
marriage. While they want to, talk about their, their brothers and sisters in Christ, you're certainly not their brother and sister if you're not in Christ, the hypocrisy is just so breathtaking, and it's just so difficult to deal with. And their universities churning out these people, and, I don't mean to say these people, but Oral Roberts University and I forget the one that's in Liberty University in Lynchburg. Is that that correct?
Founded by Jerry Falwell, the largest Christian university in the world.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. And
so your question is
near there.
So your question is, what can be done about it? Is that the question?
Is going after the tax? Are there groups that go after the tax exempt status? And is that a viable way to try to defund? I mean, the right groups are always trying to defund the left, and you know, is there a way to go after them that way?
Okay, thank you, Frederick.
Mm-hmm. Well, the answer is, once again, it's kind of a yes and no answer. No, in the sense that there's only been one church that has ever lost its C3 status because of political action in violation of the status. And it was pretty flagrant, and the IRS had to act. The IRS is, on a good day, you know, wants to do a good job. And there are plenty of people within the IRS who would love to enforce the law, which is pretty unambiguous. And politically, it's just really, really hard to do. That said, for the avenues of trying to hold churches and others who violate their C3 status accountable, there are a number of groups that do a good job of that, because they know what the standards of evidence are, and they know how to file a complaint. Americans United for Separation of Church and State in Washington, D.C., does a very good job of that. Catholics for Choice also does some of that. And so those would be two to begin with. They're not the only ones, but they know how to get it done. Now, what you can reasonably expect from that kind of process is that there's a threshold where the IRS has to investigate. You can't just say, oh, well, those people were political over there. You have to have some evidence in order to get in the door. Once they're in the door, the IRS will investigate, and usually what happens is that whoever did the violation is issued a warning saying, don't do it again. And usually that's enough to make them not do it again. Not everybody is going to completely adhere to the law, but for the people that are serious about holding on to their tax status, once the IRS does their investigation, they're saying, well, we don't want to go through that again. As a matter of practical reality, that's the best you can expect right now. The only thing that would change the circumstances is if there were enough members of Congress who were concerned about these things and articulate about these things, who could make it politically possible for the IRS to do a better job of enforcement. That's the way it is right now. It seems unlikely that that's going to change anytime soon. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's enough of a constituency demanding action on these things for anything much to happen. But that said, it's worthwhile knowing what the law is and what the standards of evidence are, collecting that evidence, giving it to groups like Americans United, and going through the process, because it will minimize abuses.
Mm-hmm. I would like to spend the last couple minutes that we have here talking about foreign policy. We've been talking about domestic policies. Let's talk about John Hagee and his strange mix of just virulent anti-Semitism and virulent support of Israel, never mind what it seems, and especially the kind of Israel that is represented through Benjamin Netanyahu. If you can talk about him and how his policy, his rhetoric, his politics have affected American politics. And we really have only like 2.5 minutes, it looks like.
Okay, well, that's a long story. We'll try to keep short.
Yeah,
John Kufi is a megachurch pastor in Texas, and he has an organization called Christians United for Israel. He's not as important as he used to be, but for a number of years, he and his Pentecostal colleagues around the country were a powerful lobby, pro-Israel lobby, in terms of the most right-wing elements of American and Israeli policy. And they were very, very effective. He is one of those who believes that Israel has a distinct role that was prophesied in the Bible, and it's their job to preserve the state of Israel, to play a role in the end times. And so he will say bizarre things like Hitler and the Holocaust were sent by God to urge the Jews to move to Israel because, according to his understanding of biblical prophecy, that's what Jews were supposed to do in order to fulfill certain biblically predicted events in the end times. And so he's has a bizarre scapegoating of Jews for their failure to adhere to his particular theology. And there have been a lot of scandals around that kind of thing with John Coffey, who's John Hagee, who's a complicated man, but fortunately not nearly as influential as he used to be because of exposure of those kinds of bizarre hypocrisies.
Mm-hmm. But we can say that this unquestioning support for Israel to a large degree is driven by the Christian right. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's a why the Christian right is generally supportive of the most right-wing pro-American foreign policy approach towards mm-hmm. Israel. And is a very important constituency, and I've seen this develop over many years, and I've always thought it's a very strange thing. And American Jews really struggle with it in terms of wanting to be supportive of the existence of Israel, but having to also contend with the Christian right, whom they don't like domestically, mm-hmm. as key strategic allies.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for